The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Yesterday, the Taliban named a new interim government. We're assessing the announcement, but despite professing that a new government would be inclusive, the announced list of names consists exclusively of individuals who are members of the Taliban or their close associates, and no women. We're also concerned by the affiliations and track records of some of those individuals. We understand the Taliban has presented this as a caretaker cabinet. We will judge it and them by its actions. The international community has made clear its expectation that the Afghan people deserve an inclusive government. The Taliban seek international legitimacy and support. Any legitimacy, any support will have to be earned.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Yeah, that was U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken. He said those words yesterday, of course, sharing concerns about the Taliban's interim government. What a mess. Whoever thought we may be sending billions of dollars? You know, I shouldn't say billions. Who knows how many millions, perhaps billions of dollars, and ultimately acknowledge them as a legitimate government. That's coming. And, of course, there's a lot of, as you heard in that comment there, a lot of caution about that. But Secretary Blinken spoke after hosting a virtual meeting of ministers from 22 countries. Okay, so this just wasn't some reporter who asked him a question. This was a statement he made to 22 countries as well as NATO and the entire EU, the whole European Union. So he reiterated the cautious U.S. response to the Taliban's naming of, you know, of the caretaker government lineup. Not surprisingly, the new Taliban administration is stacked with lots of veterans of the hardline rule from the 1990s. Some of those people are from Gitmo as well. And you know, you got to remember, these men were in a 20-year battle against, you know, our U.S.-led coalition. Whoever thought the U.S. would, you know, be leaving with its tail between its legs? I still marvel at it. I just sit back here as this news comes to me. But then I think of a little ragtag group of militiamen and patriots who didn't want oppression. They wanted freedom. And I think about the founding of our own country. Whoever thought, you know, that ragtag army could take down the mightiest navy and army in the world? It was the British Army at the time. So never say never. Never say never. But just some poor decisions. I'm not here to talk a whole lot about Afghanistan today. I want to, first of all, welcome you and just say, hey, it's good to be back. I missed you. I was away for a little bit. I actually took a trip with my wife and some friends. And we go away sometimes in September. And it was just awesome. I went to the incredibly gorgeous state of Maine. And I've been to Maine, you know, many times. I used to vacation there when I was living on the East Coast. But I had the opportunity just to pray when I was there too. You know, Maine, and this is a little fact for you. It's kind of cool. Maine has more coastline, believe it or not, than the entire West Coast of this country. Think about the Pacific Coast. Think about how big California is, right? Go all the way up the coast there. It has more, you know, water. It has more water coastline than any other state in our union. And it's partly because of all the coves that they have. I mean, Maine's not that big of a state if you look at it on a map. But if you look at the waterways, if you were to straighten that all out, miles and miles and miles. And real estate in that area right now is going through the roof. People had exodus because of COVID from New York. They have left New Jersey. They left Philadelphia. They have left Massachusetts. A lot of people had vacationed up there. They thought, hey, it'd be a nice place to work remotely or to live. But it's of pristine beauty. And my hat goes out. I think there's 144,000. Do me a favor. Do a quick search for me, Maggie. Find out what the number of Catholics in Maine are. I'm going to go with 144,000. It's not a whole lot. But I met a number of them. Very liberal government there, though. And I just, you know, we went out. We got to hang out on the water. We had a boat. 250,000 Catholics. Thank you. It was off by about 100 grand. So 250,000 Catholics. We need to continue to pray for the church there and for all that the people are going through. They certainly need it. There's some real challenges in the state, but I'll tell you more about it later. I won't go off on a tangent right now telling you about what the Marianis did, but I just want to thank Ed Morrissey for sitting in for me, for guest hosting. It's always good to you leave the show in such competent hands. Ed, thank you for what is a fantastic job. But this whole Afghanistan thing, one final thought on it, if I can. And let's pray for peace. I pray. I mean, I prayed a lot on this trip. I really did. I mean, when you're surrounded by majesty, when you're surrounded by just rugged natural beauty, you know, in the middle of this beautiful waterways, the seals are coming in and out of the water, as waves are crashing, as the sea air is, you know, is, you know, in the air. It's just you just see God. I see God in nature. We would stop, you know, at 3 o'clock. We'd pray the chaplet. We'd pray the rosary. Some of the people I'm with. It's kind of cool to do that with friends, but. I prayed for our country, too. This whole Afghanistan thing. Yesterday on Twitter, one woman stated that her husband received news and photographs that two of the translators that he had worked with while he was there, they've been found. They were found dead, actually beheaded. So we really need to pray for the citizens of this country that are left behind the borders there and for those who've helped us. And we have to pray. This is what happens when you get into bed with terrorism, when you get into bed with evil. Horrible. Photographs. Okay, she received news and photographs of these translators now beheaded. They're among a lot of people who should have been, they should have gotten out of there. That's the tragedy here. You know, before the military took off, I think we had an obligation to those who worked with us. And I think we have an obligation to our fellow citizens. We have the military, Mike. If I was president, I would have done things differently. I'm not Joe Biden. Now, Secretary of State Blinken is saying that there actually does seem to be something like a hostage situation going on in Taliban, not allowing people to fly or even, you know, to get out over the land. Surprise, surprise, right? Oh, my gosh, we didn't see that one coming, did we? Wow. There's apparently one plane with Americans and the others that the Taliban are willing to let fly out of the country, but there's been no word on whether or not it has. So we'll see what happens. I'll continue to monitor it. The president is trying to do a deflection right now. You'll see more of this a little bit later. At 5 o'clock Eastern time today, 4 o'clock Central, President Biden is expected to address the nation. And he has a six-step plan to address the COVID plan. And COVID has been great for Joe Biden. It actually put him in the White House. I really think it helped sway the election. And I think Donald Trump certainly shot himself in the foot as well with some of the things he said and the way they approached certain things. But that being said, you know, Joe Biden waved the put on the white hat and said he's going to save America from COVID. They're going to get the economy back. Excuse me. But one of the points of the plan is apparently mandating that every federal employee has to get vaccinated. And I was just having this conversation with this physician I was with, and he was saying, is it true that the White House and the CDC aren't mandating people get vaccinated? Well, if it was, not anymore. Up until now, there has been the mandate that if you didn't get it, yeah, you were allowed weekly testing. Go get your test, your PCR test. If you're clear, you can work. That option reportedly will be no longer available. So the White House spokeswoman, Jen Psaki, she said yesterday that you know, some of this is going to be related to access to testing. Some of it's going to be mandates. Some is going to be related to how, you know, we ensure kids will be protected in schools. But as I said, he'll lay out the six-point plan tonight, a little later today. And he's going to address how we're going to get a handle on these new variants, especially Delta, which is really having a profound impact. ABC News reported earlier today what you might expect from this afternoon's briefing.
So the White House, the president, they're doing this today because they say that they know that people are increasingly concerned about the Delta variant as kids are heading back to school and folks are heading back to the office. But there's also the political reality of this, that the president has seen his poll numbers start to slip when it comes to his handling of the coronavirus. The president met with his COVID response team yesterday. Later today, he's going to unveil this six-point plan. They're looking at talking about vaccinating the unvaccinated, keeping the vaccinated protected, keeping schools open and kids safe. That's an important one. Testing and mask mandates, the economic recovery and all of this, and care for those who do test positive. You know, there are a lot of big questions heading into this address today. The reality is there's only so much that the federal government can actually do when it comes to mandating vaccines in the private sector. Officials here aren't saying much this at this point about how the president is going to address booster shots today. And the White House, I'm told, is not expected, or the president, rather, is not expected to issue any broad vaccine mandates.
Yeah, that's Jen Psaki, of course, and we'll see what he does do. She's saying, we don't expect any broad mandates. Here's how crazy we've gotten and how wacky This has got. And I hope the pendulum is going to swing back. It can only go so far in one direction. The tide can only roll out so far before it comes back in, right? The federal government isn't the only place where they want to do these mandates, right? To mandate these vaccines. A lot of colleges are doing it. You might have kids going to school. Maybe they're your grandkids or nephews or nieces. Rutgers University in New Jersey. Wait till you hear what they're doing. I read this morning. I wasn't going to address it, but I thought I had to at least just had to throw this pearl on your table. You got to check this out, right? Rutgers University in New Jersey. They have a mandate in place that is so strict that they're not even allowing students who are taking their entire course load remotely, right? You can't even attend a class remotely if you have not been vaccinated. Okay, you heard me right. I know you're thinking, what did he say? You can't attend a virtual class. You can't even sign up for them unless you're vaccinated. Logan Holler, he was locked out of school. He had his school email. He was barred from signing up for virtual classes because he didn't get his vaccine shot yet. And he's been told that it could be weeks before a decision's made on whether or not they'll grant him an exception. Okay, let's just stop on that one point just for a quick second here. What's happened to common sense? The kid's at home taking his classes online. He's not been vaccinated. He has a right to do that, right? He doesn't have to. I don't know whether he's had COVID and his natural immunity or what the issue is. But why can't somebody who will not be in class and who is strictly confined to remote learning, why can't they learn without being vaccinated? That's Rutgers. I'm going to just leave it there for you. We'll look at more tomorrow. In fact, after the president addresses the nation today, tomorrow, I'll dive into this in much greater detail, let you know what the president said, and we'll give you an update on what's happening with COVID. But Maggie, why don't you open your mic? I know you put something in my stack, but what are you saying there?
We've got the news headlines here in the studio, and I just looked up and saw that the Department of Justice is preparing a challenge to the Texas heartbeat law that came into effect. So that potentially would be a federal challenge to a state. Wow.
That's big news.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, in fact, if you stay with me today, we got a lot to get into. I will dive into that a little bit later in the afternoon, our last hour of the broadcast today. I want to share with you, I know we heard a little bit of Archbishop Cordy Leone from San Francisco. He was on the air with Ed when I was gone. I want to share with you his op-ed, okay, his opinion piece. I think it's brilliant. I think it's a challenge to all of us as Catholics and Christians, and we will repost it a little bit later in the show for you on Twitter, and you can follow us at Drew Mariani Show. One final thing, okay, here, and then I'm going to change gears. Just one bit of news that I've been tracking. Have you ever been to the National Archives website? I don't know if you've done that or not. You can read any of the documents that pertain to our country's founding, right? It's a great resource for every American. You can read firsthand the primary documents that impacted our history and you can do a lot of things there, but be prepared for this. I just found out, the Washington Examiner is actually reporting this, that the depository of these documents is putting up a warning. A warning on the founding documents of this country. They're putting up a, quote, harmful language alert. A harmful language alert. I'm about to laugh out loud. Are you kidding me? It's so ridiculous, it's actually funny. So just to give you a perspective, right, the archives, the records, they span the history of the United States. And here's what the, excuse me, here's what the alert says. It is our charge to preserve and make available these historical records. As a result, some of the materials presented here may reflect outdated, bias, offensive, and possibly violent views and opinions. That is the National Archives. That warning, by the way, is in front of the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution of the United States of America. I'm speechless, to be honest with you, over it. Those are some stunning things, from Rutgers University to warnings about the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. It's like, Lord, have mercy on this great country of ours. Thank you for your incredible blessings to this great nation of ours. Because we are blessed. I really believe God has a wonderful role for us to play in the world. And we need to get that right. So let's pray for our leaders. Let's pray for their conversion. Let's pray for all of this indoctrination that's happening on so many levels, from schools now to the National Archives. And, you know, prayer works. It changes things. I want to be hopeful here. You know, you hear a lot of negative news here. Sometimes you hear the insanity of what's going on. I just want you to be in the know so that you can say, hey, I get it. And here's the proper perspective on that. It's kind of tragic. Another issue here, too. Well, one more. And I'm going to be joined today by Sister Marie Estelle. She is going to be joining me any second here. I want to share with you what happened in the state of California. And again, I try just to keep my finger on the pulse of a lot of what's happening and give you a perspective on it. The California State Legislature, they narrowly passed a bill in the dead of the night. Now, again, why the dead of the night? Why when everybody's sleeping? 6 years ago, in the dead of the night, they narrowly passed a bill to legalize assisted suicide. Now, you talk about evil, right? You talk about something sinister, something dark. That bill was then signed into law by the governor at the time, Jerry Brown. It was passed based on one case. It was a young woman named Brittany Maynard. I talked about her at length on air. She had brain cancer. Beautiful woman, right? Young woman. She wanted to kill herself rather than let cancer or the treatment do so. And so she left California because she couldn't do it in the state of California. And she went to Oregon to get the lethal drugs. And she publicized this. And she got public sympathy stirred up. A lot of people were on her side, which is one of the reasons the bill passed. So that assisted suicide law has what are called safeguards built into it. But there's a new bill right now. It's Senate Bill 380. So pay attention to this and write this one down, all right? SB 380, Senate Bill 380. And it's going to remove many of those safeguards, including ones that require mental health checks before these lethal drugs are prescribed. You know, currently there's a 15-day waiting period between when the request is made and then the drug prescribed. It also requires a mental health check, but the new bill is going to remove both those provisions. I'm joined right now by Sister Marie Estelle. She's a Carmelite Sister of the Sacred Heart of Los Angeles. She's a registered nurse. She serves as CEO of Santa Teresa, Teresita, I should say. It's a 12-acre care facility for seniors in need of assisted living or skilled, you know, nursing services. I hope you'll check them out. They're a good group. You can find them at santa-teresita, T-E-R-E-S-I-T-A.org. And Sister, thank you for all you do. I am so grateful for your time today.
Thank you, Drew. It's a joy to join you today.
And this is kind of a darker story, but give us your take, if you could. Shed some light on how real are the safeguards in the present law, and do they really do anything, or are they just window dressing right now? How do you view what we currently are dealing with?
So right now, California does have the law. Assisted suicide is part of the law, and what's sad about this bill is it's just taking away the safeguards. So there's a 15-day waiting period, which is you have to make two requests, and so remove with 15 days in between of each. And that really is not uncommon in the states that have this bill. However, we are seeing a trend in the states that have these bills to remove and reduce the amount of time. So this current bill kind of looks like the New Mexico bill that it now moves it to a two-hour window. The 15 days, well, there are a lot of flaws just with the initial bill, mm-hmm. But that is law currently. The big question is, why this bill? Why right now? Yeah. In the midst of the pandemic, where we know that the greatest difficulty that we are facing is a mental health crisis, induced by the pandemic, and we have a pandemic of isolation and disconnection already. And this bill shortens the hours of someone who may just need that mental health support. Yep. And an opportunity to really get good care. And it's just, it's frightening that we would do this at this time.
I agree. That's such a great question too. Why this bill and why now? Give me perspective on what happens here. My understanding, it's been 6 years since the law was passed, and more than 600 prescriptions were written in 2019. I think more than 400 people actually took their lives. But what does the availability of this law do in the mind? What's it do in people's minds when they're at their end of their life, when they're suffering from a difficult illness? Does that move the needle a little bit in the direction of wanting them to take their own lives? And if this was not there, do you think we'd have more people who are able to push through this and live?
You know, the end of life and facing a terminal diagnosis is not easy. And every person, I'm sure, struggles, and families, they struggle with difficult diagnoses. This gives us an opportunity to shine in our humanity at the highest when we come together to support. We really should be passing laws to increase funding for hospice and palliative care and communities that really want to walk with families, walk with those that are ill. It's a moment for us to say, we can't cure, and the church teaches us in their documents on healthcare, even when we cannot cure, we must care. And this sends a distorted message out about really the importance of every person's life made in the image and likeness of God. And it creates an atmosphere that I kind of feel is like bullying in a sense. It creates this culture in which people's mindset, as you were saying, oh, I'm going to be a burden.
Right.
Oh, I could lose, my capacity for X, Y, and Z, which are real, but how are we as a human community meeting those needs? And then it's called an end-of-life option, but if we are creating a culture by our laws that are creating an atmosphere, so to speak, of like creating this mentality that my life is not worth living because of X, Y, and Z, is it really an option?
Yeah,
and then also for those that have healthcare or lack adequate healthcare and access to treatments, this is really a health equity issue as well.
Sure.
And it was the first time this bill came around that it does target minorities and the poor. And then really, how much of an option is it for them too?
Well, sister, I only have a few moments left here, if even that. What can individuals do? What does the church need to do to counter this? And this, some people might think, this is just California. No, this type of stuff has rippled across the country and will continue to do so. I'm sure that your facility is helping residents live a very dignified and hopeful life. If people want more information, where do they get it? And ultimately, what needs to be done to change the tide on this?
Yeah, well, thanks be to God. We've never had anyone request this in our facilities, and we would not allow that to happen. We would help a family go elsewhere because that violates our ethical practices for the ethical and religious directives that we follow in the United States for all Catholic healthcare. What we need to do right now is we need to contact those of us here in California. We know that California leads the way on policy, and we need to reach out to our legislators. We need to call and email our legislators today. They might be moving the bill. It may be heard today or tomorrow. Not exactly sure. We need as many people who are speaking out on behalf of pro-life. But also, this is a bipartisan issue when you look at the effect that it's having on minorities. And really also just encouraging listeners, support the Catholic healthcare in your own diocese and your local areas, because Catholic healthcare is such an incredible gift to the world. Jesus says in John 13, verse 1, having loved his own in the world, he loved them to the end. And we need to be doing that too. We love those that are ours, our family members, our friends, our neighbors. We've been devastated by a pandemic. We are carrying the regulatory burden, and we do not need a law that continues to increase end of life.
we've seen victory when we've rallied before when it came to the threat against the sacrament of confession. The Senate bill is called 380. Call your local representative. Senate bill 380, okay? which will remove many of the safeguards for those who need them the most. Sister, thank you for being with us. You could also get more info by going to santa-teresita.org. Sister Maria Stell, the Carmelite sister there and the CEO of that great organization. I'll be back.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the Relevant Radio Studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Thank you. I can't believe I got one.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
888-914-9149.
All right, welcome back. I'll grab a couple of your calls if you are on hold, but I do want to talk about natural immunity, right? Supposedly 13 times more effective than even that jab you got. We can talk about that certainly coming up. You know what? All right, Maggie's saying, hold on the calls for a second. I'll do that. Barb, Lillian, Mary, everyone else, I'll grab your calls in a minute. I've got a guest that's going to be joining me, and I do want to get into this issue, and maybe we'll pick you up in a second. Natural immunity, I want to talk about this for a second. Have you had COVID? That's probably the first question. Maggie's nodding her head. She had COVID, right? My daughter had COVID. My son had COVID. You might have had COVID. That's a good thing if you survived it, right? If you now have natural immunity. You heard earlier that the president is going to require all federal employees to get vaccinated against COVID-19. And he's not going to allow anymore. A lot of people had an option. If they didn't want to get the vax, then they could go and get their PCR test, get tested weekly, and as long as you were clean, you could come to work. I shared, if you missed it, that Rutgers is in New Jersey. They're requiring all their students, even those whose entire course load is done remotely, who's done virtually, right? They have to get vaccinated. So you can't even take a virtual class. You can't take a remote class unless you're vaccinated. I mean, that makes no sense, right? I mean, zero sense. So that kind of mandate is pretty much a status quo right now for state-run colleges and for universities, not just students, but also for faculty. It's also for faculty as well. There are some exemptions. I always want to be fair. Both medical exemptions and religious exemptions are allowed. But one exemption isn't being given. And it's an exemption that if you've already had COVID and you have the antibodies and you don't want to do it, then why do it? In fact, let me share this with you. I'll share very quickly with you. An interview that was done. You might have heard about George Mason University professor who sued the school over his COVID-19 vaccine mandate. It was granted a medical exemption by the school. He's a law professor at I think it's GMU. And he said that he had COVID-19, he defeated it, and, you know, he has natural immunity, and he argued that should prevent him from having to get a vaccination. So you may not want to get vaccinated if you had COVID. You might be walking in this camp. Let me just share just a little bit of audio. It was an interview done by CBN. Let's give you some perspective.
I got COVID back in March 2020. It was no fun. Nobody needs to tell me not to get COVID again. And so I'm very conscious of this. And if there had been a vaccine back then, based on what I knew, I would have probably gotten it. It would have been a lot better off than getting COVID. But the reality is now I do have COVID. And it's very clear that once you have COVID and you've recovered, you've got a natural immunity. And the evidence is clear now. It used to be that it was at least as good as vaccine immunity. It quite clearly now is better than vaccine immunity, as we saw in this study that came out from Israel this week, that showed that those who have been vaccinated have a 13 times higher risk of infection, 27 times higher risk of symptomatic infection, 8 times higher risk of death than somebody with natural immunity like me. And so I was very careful. I got my antibodies tested. My immunologist said my antibodies level was comparable to somebody who had just been vaccinated. And so I don't need the vaccine in order to protect myself or those around me.
All right. So that was Todd. I believe his name is Zawit. Help me. Yeah, open the microphone for you. So Whiskey, is that his name?
I think it's Zwicky.
Zwicky? Just say it like you know it, Maggie. Just say it like you know it. My next guest will know his name because he's in a similar situation. This guy, just to give you a little more perspective on Todd I want to say Zawitski. I think that's how you say his name. He's, as I said, a law professor at George Mason University. He prevailed, right? He prevailed against his employer's lawsuit claiming that he needed to get the vaccine because he already had the COVID. So he took six tests to show that the antibodies to the disease were, you know, in his body, still present there. But he still has to maintain social distancing. And he still, even though he has have had COVID and the antibodies, he still has to be tested weekly. Dr. Aaron Cariotti, who's been a tremendous guest over the years across the Relevant Radio platform, especially in this program, he, like perhaps you, had COVID. He had it in July. He battled it, COVID of last year. He beat it. But the institution where he works, the University of California at Irvine, where he directs the medical ethics programs there, and he's a member also of the University of California's Office of the President Critical Care Bioethics Working Group, they're mandating that he gets vaccinated. And they're saying, no, you have got to get vaccinated. So he is also suing because he's saying, this is crazy. I got natural immunity. You know, I don't need the shot. We shared this before, too. There was a recent Israeli study of tens of thousands of people showed that those who had the disease, if you had COVID, you're more than 13 times less likely to get symptoms of it again than people who have been fully vaccinated. So your natural antibodies are almost 13 times better than the vaccine. Other studies have shown similar results, but this Israeli study, I think, has had the most dramatic effect. And here for some perspective and part of his story is none other than the great Dr. Aaron Cariotti. Doctor, welcome back.
Thanks, Drew. It's always good to be with you, and really glad that we're talking about this issue, which has been, of course, very much on my mind. I filed a similar suit recently in federal court against the University of California's vaccine mandate to the one that Professor Zawicki filed that you mentioned earlier at George Mason University. In fact, he and I are having lunch tomorrow. He'll be in town, so we're gonna commiserate. we had a similar mandate here, and I'm filing it, of course, not just on my own behalf, but on behalf of all the many, many people from within my institution, faculty, staff, graduate students who have reached out to me looking for help, looking for support on this issue. They know that their immunity is every bit as good, and that's actually all we need to prove in this case, is that it's equivalent to vaccine-mediated immunity if you're COVID-recovered. But the data now clearly shows, and this study you mentioned that came out of Israel, large population-based study, tens of thousands of people, and the effects were so robust. Wow. I mean, it's not even close that natural immunity is superior to vaccine immunity. That's not to denigrate the vaccines. The vaccines don't work as well as we initially hoped. That doesn't mean that they're useless. Right. You know, what I'm opposed to are coercive mandates. This is not an anti-vaccine lawsuit. This is an anti-coercion lawsuit. And it's a challenge to the idea that people who have natural immunity should be discriminated against and treated differently than people who have immunity because they took the vaccine.
I think that's such a great, great point. Where are you right now? And you indicated that your staff and a lot of people you work with are behind you. What's the mindset there at the university? Are they are people on this? Are they divided?
Well, people are divided. There is a lot of pressure on people to fall in with a mandate and take the vaccine. A lot of people have made the calculated decision that even if they didn't want the vaccine or were not inclined to get it for one reason or another, medical reason, religious reason, many people have decided, and I don't fault anyone for doing this, that, you know, this is not worth losing my job over. This is not worth having to leave the university over. But many people are still standing their ground, and in spite of pretty burdensome and oppressive testing requirements that are being placed on people who have a religious exemption or a medical exemption, or in my case, a lawsuit pending, they're deciding that I'm looking at the risks of acquiring or reacquiring COVID, and I'm looking at the risks of the vaccine, and I'm deciding to decline it. So there are a lot of people in my corner on this that are concerned about this particular issue, but also the precedent that it sets for the future. You know,
I agree.
I never put anything in my contract that said at some unspecified time in the future,
that's right,
my employer was going to be able to make medical decisions for me, you know, on pain of losing my job. Yeah. So this is a very serious issue.
You know, when you put it that way, it's like, it just seems so obvious. You know, two things here. One, I don't know whether you're tenured or not. I'm assuming you probably are, but could this hurt somebody else? If you say, no, I'm not going to do this. Could it hurt advancement? Could it hurt tenure for someone if they say no to them? And then secondly, let me ask you about the vaccine. I was going to go down this path because I really want to talk about the battle. But you have some concerns regarding taking the vaccination. That's why you're not doing it, I'm assuming. I don't know whether those are moral because of the aborted cell lines or whether it's a human test trial right now or whether, you know, you want to give it more time. I mean, I don't know what your mindset is. If you don't mind sharing that, you can.
Yeah.
You don't have to.
So let me start with your first question. Now, legally, the university cannot retaliate against anyone who's taken legal action like this. That would very much be frowned upon by the court. And, you know, to their credit, no one at the University of California has, you know, made any attempt to retaliate against me so far. I have a lot of supportive colleagues. You know, people here have been very, very civil and decent. And, you know, we may have differences of opinion on this policy. But that hasn't been an issue. It is clear that the university is going to fight this in court. They filed legal paperwork recently. You know, in anticipation of our January 27th hearing on my motion for a preliminary injunction. So they're right now they're giving every indication that, you know, this will go to court and that the legal fact-finding process will adjudicate it. My own reasons for declining the vaccine, you know, at this point, there are moral issues which we could talk about later, but it's primarily medical, and the medical issues basically come down to looking at the immunity I already have from recovering from COVID.
Right.
Nothing in medicine is perfect, but natural immunity after COVID is about as close to perfect as you can get. So somewhere in the neighborhood of 98-99% that I won't get reinfected. If I do get reinfected, there are literally zero reported cases in the literature of someone getting reinfected and hospitalized. So there are a few scattered cases of people getting reinfected with a mild case, right? But nobody getting seriously ill. So I look at those odds and I say, okay, that the risks of the vaccine I know are not zero. And we can debate about what the risks actually are. But we know, and the CDC has acknowledged, for example, that there is a small but significant risk of myocarditis, inflammation of the heart.
Yep.
And that it's more likely to occur in young men, right? So young men are less likely to have problems with COVID, but more likely to have that particular side effect. There's many other side effects that have been reported in the passive surveillance systems like VAERS for reporting adverse effects. And those need to be confirmed, and those require follow-up studies and so forth. But I'm not seeing a lot of those follow-up studies being done.
Yep.
I don't know that we have adequate surveillance to really know what the actual rates of side effects are. And so, you know, I'm dealing with a situation of some uncertainty, high likelihood of not having a problem in the future with COVID, of not passing COVID on to other people. And you know, some possibility, probably not high, but still non-zero, of having a severe adverse reaction to the vaccine. Why would I take something that has only risks, even if those risks are small, and no potential benefit?
The other
argument that's put forward is, okay, you may not be worried about yourself, Cariotti, but what about other people? You know, shouldn't you take the vaccine for the sake of the common good or the sake of, you know, the people that you're around in the hospital? And that argument, Drew, might work if these vaccines were sterilizing. And what I mean by that is some vaccines not only prevent you from getting sick when you get a virus, but they prevent you from getting infected with the virus and prevent you from passing the virus on to other people. Measles vaccine is a good example of that. The measles vaccine, fortunately, is a sterilizing vaccine. That's good because measles is extremely infectious. It's very, very contagious.
Yeah.
And when you get the vaccine, not only do you not get a bad case of measles, but you also prevent yourself from getting infected and passing it on to other people. None of the current COVID vaccines do that. They're not sterilizing. The CDC has acknowledged that a person can get infected with COVID even though they've had the vaccine. They can shed just as much virus as a non-vaccinated person, and they can spread COVID to other people. So if anything, so that argument falls apart, that you should do it for other people. And if anything, some people have suggested that vaccination creates a false sense of security. It changes people's behavior. They think, well, you know, before I got vaccinated, I wasn't going to go visit grandma who's 90 years old because I didn't want to put her at risk. But now that I'm vaccinated, I can. Well, inadvertently, a person with that assumption might put grandma at risk because they can still carry the virus and pass it on to grandma, even if they're not showing symptoms or they don't feel sick, because the vaccine is lowering their odds of getting bad symptoms. So I don't see a compelling reason why informed consent in this case can be bypassed. There's no common good argument that works in these vaccines. And that fundamental principle of medical ethics. Yeah, people have the right to informed consent and informed refusal regarding what is injected into their body.
Doctor, I'll tell you, hold the thought. When we come back, we will talk more. We'll grab a few calls. A lot of people want to join you. The CDC apparently has changed its definition of a vaccine from a product that stimulates a person's immune system to produce immunity to a specific disease, and they changed that to a preparation that is used to stimulate the body's immune response against diseases. I'd like your take on that as well. We'll take your calls, and our conversation will continue. Stay with us.
Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
All right, 10 minutes now before the top of the hour. Welcome back. It's great to be here with you today, taking a look at, what has been a continuing conversation on COVID-19. We see the specter of mandates rising. Now, the president, in about an hour and 10 minutes from now, will be addressing the nation. I'll give you some coverage on that in greater detail tomorrow as well. He's going to be looking at a six-point plan to eradicate COVID. Of course, we are dealing with new technology here. We have mRNA technology with Pfizer and Moderna. You got the J&J vaccine people object to because of its proximity to abortive fetal cells. It's a tough issue here. And now we're hearing reports that natural immunity could be 13 times more efficacious, you know, against, a future occurrence of COVID than even a vaccination. My guest, Dr. Aaron Cariotti, joins me today. He's in a lawsuit right now. He's suing his school because he has natural immunity, and they want him to get the shot. And as you just heard him articulate, he does have some reservations. And he's an intelligent, well balanced, very rational man. And I've invited him to share with us today. And Doctor, so good to have you back. Can I ask you a quick question? Then we'll jump right into the phones. We have a few minutes here. I was mentioning the CDC changed the definition of vaccination. Vaccination used to be a product that stimulates a person's immune system to produce immunity to a specific disease. They changed it to, quote, a preparation that is used to stimulate the body's immune response against diseases. Why did they do that? And should that raise any flags for us?
Yeah. Well, that just happened on September 1st, last week. And they did it, so far as I could tell, they didn't explain why they changed a longstanding definition of what counts as a vaccine. But you notice in the two definitions you read that a vaccine no longer has to, quote, produce immunity. I think the reason that they did that is, unfortunately, the new mRNA vaccines haven't been as robust and durable in terms of their efficacy as we initially hoped and as they were initially touted. And let me just say, I served on the Orange County, still serve on the Orange County Vaccine Task Force. I helped devise our vaccine allocation strategy for the University of California. I was very eager to get a safe and effective vaccine to combat this pandemic. I've had more conversations than I can count as our hospital's ethicist with families telling people that their loved one is dying of COVID and they're not going to survive. So I know how serious this illness can be for elderly people and people that are at risk. And initially, we thought these vaccines were going to be the answer to everything. And unfortunately, they're not. It doesn't mean they're useless. But the effects of the vaccine seem to be diminishing with time and with new variants.
Yes.
So the efficacy is declining. And if we're going to still count these as vaccines, which I think the CDC very much wants to do, then recognizing that in many people, and those numbers are going up now, I think in some places vaccine efficacy, and for some of the vaccines, the efficacy is around 55 to 65%. So in, you know, almost half of people that get the vaccine might not produce immunity, or it might not produce immunity that lasts longer than 6 months.
Yeah.
And we don't know what's going to happen over the next 6 months with that as well. And the idea of boosters going to fix the problem of waning efficacy? The answer is we don't know.
Yeah.
We just don't have the clinical trials to answer that question. So I think the CDC recognized that if we want to keep calling these vaccines, then the definition can't include that it has to produce immunity, or at least produce immunity in the vast majority of cases, because unfortunately these mRNA vaccines are not working out that way. Now, whether it's advisable to, to change your definition in order to accommodate this product is a whole separate and interesting question.
Well, we only have a couple minutes left. Let me get to the phones. A lot of people want to talk to you, so we'll try to sneak in as many as we can. We'll start in Portland, Maine. Joanne has been waiting, I think, the longest. Joanne, good afternoon.
Hi, Drew. And I came in a little late, and I apologize. I don't know the name of your guest, but I'm going to give you some real-world examples here from Maine. I have had COVID symptoms for 18 months, and I had an antibody test in April of 2020, completely negative, no immunity whatsoever.
Yep.
I got J&J, had an anaphylactic reaction. I just got another antibody test, still marginal. So what I think people are missing, natural immunity isn't a constant. It changes as we age. Your body's ability to fight infection changes. So the person at 16 has a much better level of immunity than the person at 60 or 80. And their ability to fight that immunity falls, which is why they are asking people to get the vaccine, because it's not an either or, it's an and. Here in Maine, there was no mandate for vaccines for healthcare workers, and it was offered. A lot of people got them. But recently, it had to be instituted because 11 staff members in our largest medical center in the emergency department came down with positive COVID, some vaccinated, some not.
Mm-hmm.
And these people are dealing every day with COVID people coming through the doors. And if you don't have COVID walking into the emergency room, by the time you leave in a hospitalization, you're at risk of getting it from your healthcare worker who may not have gotten vaccinated. And I have
Let me just take a few minutes to respond to that, because there's several things that you mentioned there, and I think a couple of them are worth clarifying. So you mentioned that both unvaccinated and vaccinated people can get COVID, which is true. It would be interesting to see that hospital's number on people who had recovered from COVID. That's what my lawsuit is about. My lawsuit is not against people getting vaccinated, or even against vaccine mandates for certain groups of people, but they're against vaccine mandates for people that have natural immunity. And one mistake that people make is to equate my level of immunity with my level of antibodies. And I say that that's a mistake, because what provides lasting and durable immunity is not circulating antibodies in the plasma, in the bloodstream. Over time, all of your antibodies will fade for any illness that you've encountered. If it's chickenpox in childhood, you may not have circulating antibodies 20 years later. That doesn't mean that you're at risk for acquiring that virus again, because what provides long-term immunity are memory B cells and memory T cells. Those are white blood cells in your bone marrow and also circulating in your bloodstream that remember what that antigen, what that virus is, and will ramp up antibody production when they encounter it again. To maintain circulating antibodies for every pathogen that you've ever encountered would take an enormous amount of energy that your body just can't maintain. So the idea that immunity fades because antibodies fade is not true. It's a myth. And there are actually tests out there for people who no longer have circulating antibodies. There are T cell tests that you can take to see if you have durable long-term immunity against COVID and other viruses. So I think it's very clear and it's very important for people to understand that circulating antibodies alone will not tell you whether or to what extent you have immunity against COVID or any other pathogen.
Hey, doctor, thank you. Phones are stacked. I wish we had just a few more minutes for you. We're going to pray the chaplet coming up. I'm going to pray for you, for your case, and I look forward to the next time you're on. It's always informative and a lot of fun. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Drew.
That's Dr. Aaron Cariotti. Say a prayer for him, if you would. We will pray together in just a couple seconds. The Chaplet of Divine Mercy is straight ahead.